Now, back to Vocal Point with your host, Jerry Newcomb, on GraceNetRadio.com.
All right, let's see if this works here. Hello, Adam.
I'm here.
Ah, fantastic. Okay, Adam Savitt, production manager for the Center for Security Policy, which is more than just a think tank in Washington, D.C. I remember you all are on Pennsylvania Avenue. And what
That's
exactly
correct.
Is the Center for Security Policy?
Well, our basic motto is peace through strength. And what we do is support policies that strengthen the United States abroad, enhance our national security. And one of our programs is to combat Sharia law, which is a nonviolent form of jihad, which not many people in D.C. are working on. And, of course, the current regime in power doesn't really believe in. So that is our unique mission.
Huh. Okay, what is Sharia law? And by the way, for lack of a better term, the overall title of this show, if you will, is How Do You Solve a Problem Like Sharia? That's not original, but go ahead.
Sure. Well, I'd say the number one way you solve the problem is identifying it. And that is the number one problem we have here in D.C. is that people are afraid to identify the problem. And unless you identify the threat doctrine, of course, how can you hope to combat it?
Sure.
But just the basics on Sharia, though. Sharia is based on the Quran, which is the received words to the Prophet Muhammad, as well as the Hadiths, which are the sayings of Muhammad as recorded by his contemporaries. It's a totalitarian system. It governs every aspect of Islamic life. And by definition, it cannot coexist with our Constitution. That's because the Constitution is a man-made law. Their only authority is the Quran, therefore, Constitution out the window. Sharia sees the world in two distinct ways. Number one, Dar al-Islam, the House of Islam. That's where Islam is dominant, and Sharia is enforced both on Muslims and non-Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Dar al-Harb, the House of War, and that's where fighting is permitted against the infidel. They are required to spread the House of Islam into the House of War until the entire world is the House of Islam.
Now, if I'm correct, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, it's my understanding that when it comes to violent Muslims killing other human beings, that more actually happens of Muslims killing Muslims because, the number one, they're the ones close to them, but number two, they perceive these other Muslims as not being faithful and devout as Muslims. So it's almost like if you have an active Muslim killing a nominal Muslim, but that just the sheer numbers of dead corpses, that's more than Christians, more than Jews, and more than just secular people that have no religious identification, more than Hindus, etc.
That is absolutely correct. And as you point out, the main reason is those are the people closest who they can attack. And it seems that within Islam, it just inevitably happens that, yes, there are different levels, different strata. Let's take Egypt. That's somewhere where our eyes are on. So you have
sure.
The Christians who are the most oppressed, but yes, they're only 10%, so they're not the main casualties. Then you have the seculars in Egypt. Then you have the Muslim Brotherhood, which, of course, the current President Morsi belongs to, and which is what we would consider an extremist organization. However, there is an organization even more extreme than them, which are called generally the Salafists. And yes, those Salafists can consider the Muslim Brotherhood to be infidels. So yeah, you have many levels of, let's say, increasing extremism, and those extremists see the other Muslims as infidels, therefore as legitimate a target as Christians or Jews, absolutely.
Well, this is like with, you know, the bad times, let's say, during medieval Europe, where sometimes you had Christians, quote-unquote, killing other human beings whom they labeled as heretics, and then, you know, history would show, well, wait a minute, those were actually dissenting Christians that you just killed in the name of Christ, which is totally antithetical to Jesus Christ. But that's interesting. So sometimes Muslims will view their fellow Muslims as infidels because they're not devout enough, or they don't dot the right I's or dash the right T's.
Absolutely. And well, to go to the Christian comparison, the important thing here is ideology. And as you state, at the core of Christianity is tolerance, is love of the fellow man, is, you know, don't inject yourself into politics or violence. Let the secular forces deal with that. But in Islam, Sharia is specifically political. It does command conquest. It does command violence. And therefore, you can say a Christian is improperly interpreting to use violence. However, a Muslim, unfortunately, is interpreting correctly.
All right. Now, as far as Sharia, is it possible that a devout Muslim could be still a good citizen of the United States and he is or she is faithfully following Sharia for them? In other words, Sharia says this is how I'm going to bathe, this is how I'm going to treat my neighbor, etc.
That's right. You absolutely can. And that's because, especially in the United States, it comes down to individual liberty. It comes down to individual choice. And if a man says, I'm a Muslim, I'm following my faith as I understand it, the most prominent one is Zudi Jasser, who's an absolute hero, a doctor out of Arizona, who's outspoken on this, and he believes he's a committed Muslim as well as a tolerant and proud American citizen. The problem is the majority see Sharia in the way I'm describing it, and that is borne out by their actions, by their pattern of voting, by the way they construct society. And so, unfortunately, the violent and the supremacist form of Sharia is ascendant. Now, we can argue on whether that is the correct form as far as the Quran, letter by letter. The problem is the average Muslim sees it that way.
All right. How do you feel the United States is handling the issue of Sharia? For example, you mentioned Dr. Jasser. Well, we interviewed him for our ministry, Truth in Action Ministries, and he said, look, I'm a medical doctor. I have to do diagnoses. If the diagnosis is wrong, then it's bogus. He said when the Defense Department did an 86 whatever it was, page report on the Fort Hood shooter who was yelling out Allahu Akbar, and they never mentioned Islam, they never mentioned the Quranic motivation of the shootings, they totally missed the mark, and the diagnosis is bad, and we can't treat the problem. We're just chasing our tails.
Absolutely. That's absolutely true, and it comes down to the ideology of our elites, which is political correctness above facts. These facts are obvious. The Fort Hood shooter was wearing a traditional Islamic garb. He shouted Allahu Akbar.
Which means Allah is the greatest.
Correct. And this is shouted across the world. You'll hear this for the Syrian rebels. Yep. You'll hear this in Egypt. This is accompanying gunfire usually. And that was the case in Fort Hood. And unfortunately, the military elites who seem to become politicians at that level are enforcing political correctness above the facts and above the protection of American citizens and soldiers. And that goes for the foreign policy as well, where the Obama administration is empowering the Muslim Brotherhood forces against all logic, against what they say about their supremacist positions. And if somehow, as the administration official James Clapper said, it's somehow a tolerant secular organization. I don't know where he's getting that information.
He said that about the Muslim Brotherhood?
Correct.
That's outrageous. What do they say? The Quran is our foundation or our constitution. Jihad is our way. Dying for the sake of Allah is the highest glory, etc.
That's correct. Everything they are is religious and violent. Yet there are secular peaceful organizations. It's amazing. And, of course, reality comes back to bite you. Reality comes back in the fact that Mr. President Morsi in Egypt is seizing power, as we knew he would, and is enforcing Sharia from the top down.
Yeah. And look at, by the way, before I leave the subject of the Fort Hood shooting, there are real live implications for this. Not only, number one, does it help open the door potentially for another such attack, because this man was promoted despite his jihadist type, declarations in public.
Okay.
So
right.
He was a man that should have not been promoted and should have been watched, but instead he was free to do what he did. He killed more than 10 human beings. Those army people are not heroes. They're just the victims of workplace workplace violence?
Violence.
That's outrageous, as opposed to they're dead because they were infidels.
That's right. And that is,
and they lose again benefits.
That's right. It's due, again, to either willful blindness,
they're survivors,
blindness, or it's hard to know what the cause is, but the effect, it's mainly political correctness. That's what it is, because not only was he not fired, he was promoted, and it's a form sort of affirmative action in that they were afraid to criticize him because he was a minority, but also specifically because Muslims are perceived as being a threat. Somehow then we have to go out of our way to feel, to present that they're not a threat. And so one thing on his business card, it said he was a soldier of Allah. He gave slideshow presentations where he praised Al-Qaeda and other violent terrorists. It's a self-enforced blindness. And let me insert a word that your listeners may or may not be familiar with, which is dhimmi, D-H-I-M-M-I. And that is the status of minorities, Christians and Jews, under Islam. And, for example, they can't build churches. They can't walk on the same side of the street. They are second-class citizens. And part of that is you must not insult Islam. You must not commit blasphemy. And in effect, through our own political correctness, we are becoming dhimmi. Without the force of arms, simply through the force of our own misperception of the situation and basically our own timidness about the threat. And yes, it's horrible. It's a backwards world.
Would you say that in some ways being in the dhimmi status would be akin to, let's say, being black in the Jim Crow law days in the South?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Although in some ways it's worse in that in the American system, at least those people were able to rise themselves out of that. And there were facets of the American system, such as our Constitution, that did grant equal rights that we could stand on and eventually get those people out of it.
Right.
The foundational document being the Quran has no such clauses in there. It is eternal.
Yeah, well, as Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said, America's problem isn't with its creed, that all men are created equal. It's the fact that we're not living up to the creed. So that's the difference.
Right.
What is your website for more information at the Center for Security Policy, Adam?
You can go to securefreedom.org.
Securefreedom.org. And you all put together a wonderful book on the whole issue of Sharia. What was that called?
That was called Sharia Threat to America. So you can Google that. As well, we have a 10-part video course, which I recommend to everyone, very detailed, very referenced. It's called Muslim Brotherhood in America. That's mbinamerica.com, or you can Google it.
All right, sir. Thank you so much. Keep up the great fight,
Thanks.
Adam. Okay, bye-bye
Thank
now.
You, Jerry.
All right, that's Adam Savitt, production manager at the Center for Security Policy. And we will continue with this theme of Sharia. In fact, we're going to be talking with a medical doctor who has begun writing incredible books on the subject of Islam. His name is Dr. Andrew Bostom, and I'm holding in my hands this huge book called Sharia versus Freedom, The Legacy of Islamic Totalitarianism. Again, his name is Andrew Bostom. The foreword here is by Andrew McCarthy. I had the privilege about a year and a half ago to interview McCarthy. McCarthy was not only an author, I think, I forgot the name of his book. Oh, The Last Jihad, The Great Jihad. The Grand Jihad is what it was called. But he put away the blind sheikh. So he served as a prosecutor in the 1990s and was successful in prosecuting those who were behind the first attack on the World Trade Center. Of course, they came back after that attack in 1993. They came back in 2001 and finished the job. Dr. Bostom, as I understand it, was awakened to the threat of Islam on 9/11. Dr. Bostom, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Jerry.
Sure. Now, you have written a few books since 9/11. Why don't you go ahead and just talk about your own personal background and where Islam fits in?
I was very almost entirely absorbed in my academic medical career at the time of 9/11. My wife was actually pregnant with our second child at the time, and she saw the second plane hit the second tower, called me immediately, and that's really where everything got started, frankly. I mean, I picked up a couple of books on Islam. We were wired that night. We grew up in New York originally and emigrated. We did our residencies up in Rhode Island and wound up staying here. I was just reading to her after we accounted for everyone in New York, I was just reading to her from what I later learned to be a very apologetic work by Karen Armstrong, who's a notorious apologist.
Yeah.
And,
for Islam.
For Islam,
yeah,
exactly.
Former Anglican nun, and she's totally gone off the deep end as far as my perspective. But go ahead.
Well, I think it was her little mini biography of Muhammad, and you know, my wife is a very astute woman, not particularly versed in the subject, but I was reading passages from this apologetic, and she started laughing, and I said, well, you know, honey, this is the same prattle that we're hearing on the television screen, and I don't think it's very funny. There's a disconnect, and really, it was that inspiration that led me to make use of the vast resources at Brown University, where I taught in the medical school and where, you know, residents trained, and I returned to the campus basically for the, you know, other than teaching at the medical school, and began to just, you know, pour through the library. I had a couple of good mentors who are independent scholars who helped a great deal at the beginning, and one of them encouraged me to put together my first book, which was The Legacy of Jihad. And that's really where it all began.
Well, this book is tremendous. If for nothing else, just all the quotes in it. There's more than 700 pages with a complete index. But you open up, for example, with a lot of quotes, including one of my favorites from George Washington. I know he wrote one of the synagogues. I think it was the one in Savannah, Georgia, where he says this. Happily.
No, it's actually, Jerry, it's here.
It's in Truro? Oh, it's the Truro one.
Yeah.
Yeah, in Newport.
You can still, as a matter of fact, my son just took a school field trip there yesterday, and you can see the letter, which has been preserved, you know, at least a replication of it has been preserved.
Washington said, okay, and this is fantastic. Happily, the government of the United States, which gives to bigotry no sanction, to persecution no assistance, requires only that they who live under its protection should demean themselves as good citizens in giving it on all occasions their effectual support. Now, you go on, you have all these different quotes from all kinds of different scholars on the subject of how Sharia and such tolerance, you know, are not coexistent.
Oh, they're antithetical. I mean, and that really is the theme of the book. And I found it striking. You could juxtapose what was happening in the United States, and particularly at its founding. I mean, very strong Judeo-Christian roots, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And at the same time, I just pointed out to my son when he went to Truro the other day, in my second book, which was The Legacy of Islamic Antisemitism, at exactly this same period, so it actually lasted for a couple of years, 1790 to 1792, the Jews of Morocco were under a horrible reign of persecution, violent, Sharia-based persecution, at exactly the same time that this was going on. And this kind of juxtaposition, people are other than super specialized scholars, are absolutely clueless about. You know, there's a broader understanding of, you know, the persecution that Jews experienced in Western Europe, but there's absolutely no understanding of the grinding persecution that they faced under Islam. And I found it striking that Washington, at a time where you know America wore its Christianity on its sleeve, could utter and really abide by such words at precisely the same time the Jews were under this, you know, grinding persecution which comes directly out of the Sharia.
Right. That's a very good point. And by the way, there you are in the state of Roger Williams. Roger Williams was, of course, the Puritan who was in some ways shunned by fellow Puritans, but I think he essentially out-Puritaned the other Puritans, and he was the first to allow freedom of conscience, you know, for all people, including Jews. But let's focus on the subject of Sharia itself, Sharia versus freedom. You basically maintain in this book that Sharia and freedom, let's say Sharia and the U.S. Constitution, they're incompatible.
Yeah, and I think just very briefly, to so that your listeners can understand what the Sharia is, it derives from Islam's most important canonical text, so the Quran itself, and then the traditions of Muhammad, which are put together in a whole series of volumes that I, you know, very loosely speaking, could be seen as analogous to the Gospels. They're the collections of his the impressions, supposedly of his words, as recounted by the his earliest followers, the earliest Muslims. And then there are also some sacralized literal biographies of Muhammad called the Sirah. The Hadith and the Sirah form the traditions. So from the traditions of Muhammad, from the Quran itself, a whole series over centuries of jurists, of legists, actually codified these ideas. Some were already explicitly laws in these original texts, but others required, you know, explanations, etc. They codified this body of law, but it's not just law. It encompasses the totality of human existence. It includes things that could be recognized as religious rituals.
Sure.
But it has a whole political realm which is attached to it by indissoluble bonds. I mean, they're still there today. And this is where it runs afoul of Western, of U.S. Principles of constitutional law. So the doctrine of jihad, this eternal warfare to subjugate the infidel to the system of Sharia, is part of the Sharia. It's basic rights that we believe, you know, come from the Judeo-Christian God, ultimately, freedom of conscience, freedom of expression, these are abrogated under the Sharia. There's a whole body of law, actually, which is attached to the jihad, which has to do with discriminatory regulations against non-Muslims, and they're often very dehumanizing regulations, but they also apply, in many respects, to Muslim women themselves, and they are treated as nothing more than chattel under the Sharia. And then finally, even Muslim men, you know, who are at the pinnacle of this hierarchy, they themselves are subjected to punishments that we would consider to be dehumanizing. So lashing for alcohol consumption, mutilating punishments, amputations for theft, and stoning to death for adultery, although that usually happens to women.
By the way, I would just giving a Christian perspective here. You're coming from a Jewish perspective. I'm coming from a Christian perspective. I would say that the Gospels would be part of the sacred text, which would be the Holy Bible, to use the analogy that, you know, to compare the Bible with, say, the Quran. But the Hadith, the Hadith would be like the writings of the early church fathers. So, in other words,
that's a better analogy.
To use that analogy. Okay, so maybe a listener down, you know, who's listening to us, that's thinking, wait a minute. I know this nice Muslim family down the street. They're not about to blow me up. What is this guy talking about?
Right, and I think we have to separate. We have to separate the dogma, the doctrine, from individuals, and particularly in a country like this, although it's increasingly shifting away from the model, it is a melting pot, and we are all supposed to abide by, you know, constitutional law. So I would, and many, and Muslims in this country have a significant number have escaped Islamic societies because frankly they rejected the Sharia. Now it's often difficult for them to say that publicly, but that is a reality. On the other hand, institutional Islam in this country, and I go into great detail about that, again separating it from individual Muslims, is rife with a lot of the same problems that we see in the Islamic heartlands, in the Middle East, in Asia and Africa, and this is very problematic. And I think that one of the examples I give in the book is something called the Assembly of Muslim Jurists of America. Now, this is a mainstream Islamic teaching organization that trains imams in the U.S. and Canada but also runs a public access website where fatwas, religious rulings, are provided for anyone inquiring via the internet. And it's, I include a number of these fatwas, and unfortunately, you know, they're full of all the sort of medieval obscurantism that we associate with Middle Eastern Islam, and they deal very plainly with issues, frankly, that they shouldn't even be addressing. They have nothing, they have no role in this society. So issues of blasphemy, issues of apostasy, and they reiterate the classical Sharia-based punishments, which are death. One school of Islamic law, of Sunni Islamic law, the Shafi'ite school, sanctions female genital mutilation, and that's why, for example, female genital mutilation rates in Egypt, on the one hand, and far-flung Indonesia, on the other hand, are well over 90%. That's because both countries are under this Shafi'ite school of jurisprudence. Well, the jurists from the Assembly of Muslim Jurists of America include a lot of Shafi'ites, and they sanction female genital mutilation. They've also issued fatwas which say that offensive jihad could eventually be applicable against the United States. And this is not considered a radical organization. This is a mainstream teaching organization. Now, that doesn't mean that all Muslims in this country are abiding such rulings. Obviously not. But again, there are profound problems with institutional Islam in America. And I'll give you one other piece of data. A survey of 100 mosques was done with the hypothesis that...
In the United States?
Yes, in the United States.
Okay.
So a random sample of 100 U.S. mosques was identified and was surveyed. Had to be done, under surreptitious conditions. But
sure,
it was a random sample, and the examiners went in and identified themselves as wanting to attend the mosques or something like that. But they were all Arabic trained. Some of them had been in military intelligence. And from this sample, they set up, the hypothesis was that the more Sharia compliant the mosques were, in other words, the gender separation, very specific tight prayer rows, absence of jewelry, things like that, so they created a scale, which was actually developed for them by a former jihadist. And they said the hypothesis was the more Sharia compliant the mosque were, the more likely they would be to foment jihad via actual sermons or audio and visual materials and books that were provided, within the mosque. And there was a striking correlation between the Sharia compliance and the fomenting of jihad. And in terms of just looking at whether jihad was being actively fomented or not, 81% of the mosques were fomenting jihad, either via sermons or audio visual materials, or via reprinted literature that was being distributed at the mosque. So, again, now mosque attendance is hardly 100% in the United States, but we have problems with institutional Islam in this country. The last piece of data I'd like to give you was a survey that was just published, I think, within the last couple of months, maybe as recently as 6 weeks ago, by a research firm that's based out of the Midwest, and it's a polling company, and they didn't do a random digit dial telephone survey, which is sort of the gold standard. As an epidemiologist,
sure,
that's what I'm used to. What they did is probably the next best thing. It's more of a convenience sample. They got trade lists from marketing firms, and they validated a series of Muslim-sounding names, and then took a random sample of that group of Muslim-sounding names who had been confirmed that they were actually Muslim families, and then from that sample, they got a sample of 600 who turned out to be, if anything, the bias was, you would think, away from radicalism, because they were better educated, they had higher socioeconomic status. Well, regardless, 60% of that sample, and this was right on the heels of the Innocence of Muslims, video that caused such tumult in the Muslim world, 60% of this American sample felt that there should be punishment for any perceived insults to Islam or to Islam's prophet Muhammad. Now that's a fundamental rejection of the First Amendment. And yet again, this better educated, better socioeconomic status situated sample, had such high rates of rejection of a core value. So that to me was a very ominous finding.
Yeah, I could see why. And in fact, you mentioned fatwa earlier. A fatwa is basically a religiously sanctioned death warrant. And
No, it's a ruling in general. I mean,
ruling. Okay. Well, included in fatwas, if you get a fatwa against you, you basically have a death sentence. Like Salman Rushdie has a fatwa against him.
That's the popular identification because of the Rushdie affair. And
oh, okay.
And more recently, well, let's just go to yesterday's news.
Yeah, the eight Coptic Christians now have a fatwa against them. If you find them, kill them, say the Egyptian clerics.
That's right. And I find this so, there's so many ironies here. The ruling, you know, the beef that the so-called liberals in Egypt now have against Morsi, President Morsi, the Muslim Brotherhood president of Egypt now that we in various ways abetted. The beef against him because of what he did last Thursday in assuming greater powers is that he was putting restraints on the judiciary. Okay, that's what the liberals, so-called liberals in Egypt, are complaining about. And yet, I didn't see any outrage when, you know, a judicial body that's still functioning issues this absolutely heinous rule that is a death sentence to expatriate Coptic Christians from Egypt, and also throw in for good measure Terry Jones, who was not even an Egyptian citizen. Now these other individuals had ties to Egypt, and I don't know if all of them, maybe some of them were dual citizens. I have no idea. But the so-called liberals in Egypt, I haven't heard a single one of them come out and protest this decision.
They can't. As Christine Brim of the Center for Security Policy says, basically when you're in that kind of system and you oppose it, your options are either silence or death. Silence or death. And I think that's true. And I noticed her name in one of the acknowledgments of your books.
Yes. She's a colleague and friend. But I think we have it just drives home. I mean, Morsi is the first, openly elected president of Egypt for a reason. It's not by accident. If you looked at polling data that stretched back 5 to 6 years before he eventually was elected president, you would see that the attitudes amongst the Egyptian population, and this is by different polling agencies, none of them, conservative, they're all left-leaning polling agencies from the University of Maryland. World Opinion Dynamics did a shared poll back in 2006-2007. Pew, obviously, is not a conservative organization. What the pool data show you is that 70-75% of the Egyptian population fits what we would consider to be a fundamentalist mindset. And two things jump out. And I actually can remember the exact numbers because I was so struck by them. 67%, and this goes back to a 2006 into 2007 poll, favored the creation or recreation of a caliphate, so the early Islamic empires. And concordant with that result was 74% of Egyptians favored, and the word was strict, application of Sharia law. Now, Pew, a few years later, looked at some of the so-called Hod punishments, these mandatory punishments under the Sharia. So, again, mutilation for theft, putting apostates to death, stoning for adultery. And again, the numbers for these individual punishments were anywhere from 70 to 85% favored them. So
what that means is that if a Muslim, let's say, in Egypt becomes a Christian, the vast majority of Muslims in Egypt believe that that person should be put to death.
That number I remember, Jerry, 84%, according to a Pew poll. That was as recent as 2010, I believe.
Wow.
So, given the void created by deposing Mubarak, I mean, who do you think was going to step into that void if there were a free and fair election? So I don't understand, you know, all the hand-wringing about the Muslim Brotherhood and other, you know, traditionalists. Yeah. I would call them traditionalists. There are others call them fundamentalist parties. I mean, if these are the attitudes of the masses of Egyptian Muslims, then of course they're going to elect people like that. And, you know, I don't know why there's any great surprise about it.
Sure. Okay, we're talking right now with Andrew Bostom. That's like the word Boston, but with an M at the end. His book is called Sharia versus Freedom, The Legacy of Islamic Totalitarianism. An incredible book, very big, very thick, very well documented, and also with a great index. And just for the commercial, give us a website or something for more information on the book, and then I'm going to ask you another question.
Oh, sure. It's it could be all lowercase, dot Andrew Bostom, all together as one word. .org, and then for the blog, it would just be /blog.
Okay, here's the phrase from the Muslim Brotherhood. The Quran is our constitution, the Prophet Muhammad is our leader, jihad is our path, and death for the sake of Allah is our most lofty aspiration. Can you comment on that?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's been the credo from the movement's founding by Hassan al-Banna in the late 1920s. Frankly, it's also part of the Hamas covenant, the 1988 Hamas covenant, and Hamas just views itself as an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood. But it ties together the centrality of jihad and martyrdom for the spread of Islam, and it's Sharia, and this is the abiding these are the abiding principles of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is a mass Sunni movement, and we're seeing this now reflected in the other unrest that's characterized the Orwellian named Arab Spring. I mean, so the movement has finally broken through in gaining access to political machinery and actual voting, it's not the least bit surprising. It's a traditionalist Islamic movement. You know, Islam has had many reformations, but somehow it missed both the Renaissance and the celebration of the individual. And the Enlightenment and the separation of church and state, but it's had reformation after reformation after reformation driving it back to the foundational sources.
Hmm. Yeah, and in fact, it's like one of the specials we did many years ago. The question within Islam for the good Muslim is, what would Muhammad do? Just like we talk about, what would Jesus do? What would Muhammad do? And Muhammad was a warrior, a religious warrior. And there's
He was a prototype jihadist. I mean, this was actually stated, speaking of the Muslim Brotherhood, by their spiritual guide, their overall spiritual guide, Yusuf al-Qaradawi. He gave a sermon back in 2011, which translates into English, the Prophet Muhammad as a jihad model.
It's amazing in your book to see so many different parts where you're talking about Adolf Hitler and how Hitler worked together with some Muslim groups because of their mutual hatred of the Jews.
Well, there is a connection. Hitler romanticized Islam, and Muslims romanticized Hitler. I mean, it's probably the simplest way to put it. One of Hitler's colleagues maintains, and we don't know if this is apocryphal, that he commented about being disappointed that Charles Martel had defeated the Muslims, known in that era as the Moors, and prevented the more extensive Islamization of Western Europe. He had hoped, again, according to this anecdote, that Germany had been Islamized and that it wouldn't have what he saw as this flimsy religion, Christianity. It would have had, you know, the manly and warlike religion of Islam, and that combined with the pagan Teutonic lineage would have created a master race all the way back then. you know, there's also there's an account as far back as 1926 as of Hitler having read the work of this Indian jihadist who was known as al-Mashriqi, and eventually they met, and again, according to al-Mashriqi, Hitler extolled jihadism and was very aware of it. You know, again, relatively early in his political career.
Hmm. All right, we have just a couple of minutes to wrap up. What do you want us to know about Sharia versus freedom? What do you want to say in the last couple of minutes?
Well, I think what we have to understand is that they are antithetical. The Sharia is really certainly in its political aspects, it's a totalitarian system, very much analogous to modern totalitarian movements that are much more familiar to Americans, like fascism and like communism, and that it must absolutely, you know, no encroachment of the Sharia. You know, there's been talk about family courts and things like that, but even those aspects would be intolerable for Muslim women in terms of the discriminations, even in, you know, common divorce cases, et cetera. So I think we have to be very steadfast in saying that there is absolutely no room for Sharia in a society like ours. And moreover, if we are to get involved in further adventures in the Muslim world, we should have absolutely nothing to do, as we unfortunately did in Afghanistan and Iraq, in creating Sharia-based constitutions or in promoting them.
Oh, that's an excellent point. What about honor killings in Sharia?
Well, there there are aspects of Islamic law, you know, absolute deference to parental wishes. You can look at this in some of the common Islamic law manuals, like Reliance of the Traveler, which is probably the best one available translated into English and still used by Al-Azhar University, the sort of Vatican of Sunni Islam in Egypt, which would allow this practice. Some of it is tribal; it doesn't just occur in Islamic societies. But absolutely, it has certainly become an endemic problem, not only in Islamic societies, but in Muslim communities that live in the in non-Muslim majority communities.
Well, that's true. In fact, for example, there was a father, taxi driver, I believe, in Texas, who shot in cold blood his two daughters because they were starting to date some, you know, Western boys, Americans. And he shot them and then, you know, went on a flight to Egypt and so forth. This is done with the sanction, as he understood it, of Sharia. So Sharia versus freedom?
Well, yeah. They're considered, you know, they can be accused of blasphemy. They can be accused of apostasy. And obviously those are offenses punishable by death.
Yeah, absolutely. Sharia versus freedom, an incredible book, must have, especially if you want to really understand this threat. The Legacy of Islamic Totalitarianism, that again is the subtitle. Andrew Bostom has put this together. Thank you so much for writing this.
Thank you, Jerry.
Congratulations. And the website for more information is Andrew Bostom, like Boston, but with an M at the end, .org. Thank you so much and all the best.
Thanks again. Take care.
Okay, bye-bye. Well, that wraps up today's program. And be sure to tune in next week for Vocal Point. I'm your host, Dr. Jerry Newcomb. We'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to Vocal Point. The views and opinions were those of the host, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of GraceNetRadio.com or any of its staff, management, or affiliations. Join us next Thursday at noon for Vocal Point on GraceNetRadio.com.